Welcome to Dark Mood Woods, the Twin Peaks podcast. Hi, I'm Ethan. Joining me is...
Hello, this is Nick.
I see what you did there. Of course, we will be discussing on today or tonight's podcast, really, depending when you're listening to it, episodes 3 and 4, or hours 3 and 4, I should say, of The Return. And we should note, these two episodes have not actually, at least as of the time of this recording, not actually aired yet on Showtime, but are available through their streaming service and many other streaming services. So they're out there, and it's, I think, fair to talk about them right now.
Yes, absolutely. I'm here talking
about it. All right, well, let's get into it. So hour 3 begins with where exactly would you say Cooper is throughout this first 15 or so minutes?
He is in some sort of interdimensional hyperspace section directed by Guy Maddin, is what I would say. And there are, in this sequence, which I will just talk about this, assuming that the listener has seen it, so I don't have to go into too many terms. A setting that I think fairly closely recalls the opening scene of Eraserhead, with the man in the planet, played by none other than Jack Fisk, as he is launching something from some sort of projectile. And Cooper meets what would otherwise be a very Lynchian-looking woman, except for the fact that she has had some kind of grafting done over her eyes, and through a very stuttery, distorted sequence, she guides him to the top of some sort of spacecraft, let's say. And from there, other things happen, I suppose. He runs into what appears to be Ronette Pulaski, the woman who was present when Laura Palmer was murdered some 25 years prior. And then his soul or his body or both are sucked out through some kind of portal into the real world, where he supersedes, takes the place of a man named Dougie, who is also played by Kyle MacLachlan, with a very bad wig and a very ridiculous coat, and, most crucially, the green ring from Twin Peaks Firewalk with Me that is so essential a part of the Twin Peaks mythology, which, as I'm sure listeners know, supposedly allows its wearer to travel between the Black Lodge and the real world, and perhaps through time itself. That's what happens on a literal level. As for how it's supposed to add up, I don't quite know. And for that matter, I don't think I especially care, because I found the sequence at once very beautiful. I remember somebody on Twitter said that it was basically a TIFF wavelength short that was playing on Showtime. And then there is, for those who don't know, Wavelengths is a program that the Toronto International Film Festival puts on every year. Whether or not they'll put it on this year seems more of a question, but the experimental nature of it was, even for this show, fairly off the charts. And then you go into this guy who is with, can we assume it's a prostitute that he's with?
Yes. He pays her.
He pays her. Okay, fair enough. And yeah, Ethan, what did you make of this opening sequence?
Well, there's so much to talk about, but I think what least struck me with the two female cameos is, I believe the first woman, if correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that's the Japanese woman from Inland Empire who has the long extended monologue in that film. Am I right?
Oh, I don't know.
I'm pretty sure it was her. And
Ronette... The one who talks about the hole in her vagina?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And Ronette is curiously credited as American Girl in the credits. But what, too, I thought was interesting about both these sequences is how they, both these characters feel like essentially examples, again, of the kind of battered woman within the Lynch canon who it feels like kind of taking those scenes from his film and but putting them into this interdimensional context where, of course, throughout them, there's this urgency of there's this banging on the door. And specifically, Ronette, or American Girl, I should say, says, "Quick, my mother's coming." I mean, maybe that's a mystery that will eventually be solved. But also, I mean, talking about the getting transported into the real world, he's actually sucked out through an outlet. So, I mean, it continues, obviously, the electricity theme that's introduced throughout Twin Peaks. Or more specifically, the film Fire Walk With Me. But Lynch, should be noted, has a dream project he's wanted to make ever since, I believe, the late 70s called Ronnie Rocket. It was originally going to be his follow-up to Eraserhead, and he, for decades later, kept trying to make it, but it was always just a little too out there, I think, to get the financing he wanted. And that's about, I believe it's about a teenager who can travel through electricity. And I'm really getting the feeling with this that he's kind of scratching the Ronnie Rocket itch, so to speak. And kind of what I love, too, about setting all this up, whether it's just the image of Cooper getting sucked through an outlet or Dougie or whatnot, is just this kind of the plasticity of Cooper, or more so McLaughlin throughout of this. Think about, we're 4 hours into this 18 hours. We've seen him as this Frank Booth-esque villain, this kind of... waddling quiet dude who's just like an observer to chaos, and now it briefly the kind of Dougie who's, you know, kind of a cuck.
He's a cuck?
Yeah.
How so?
Well, he just seems like the kind of like bumbling like suburban dad. And I mean, that's another example, we just talked about the Matthew Lillard character. It feels like, again, we are seeing a lot of suburban homes throughout this 4 hours so far. I mean, we're getting South Dakota middle class. We're getting Nevada middle class.
And we will be getting shade soon of sort of a Las Vegas middle, upper middle class, I would say.
Yes. So, I mean, I think this is really, this episode is where, I mean, I kind of alluded to it on our last episode, but where the tone really starts to shift, I think you could say.
Well, yeah, I mean, as it becomes sort of, I mean, a mutual friend of ours, Sophie Ramvari, posted on Twitter a screen cap of the opening title card from Being There with Peter Sellers and said, starring Agent Cooper, and that seems exactly right. Another person said that it's basically E.T. starring Dale Cooper, which I had thought of, and then I thought of it actually as I was watching it, and then to see that sort of reinforced was reassuring to know I'm not totally nuts. It becomes, I think, sort of expressly comedic, although there are still shades of darkness in it. There's a very kind of Mulholland Drive-esque cabal that is out to assassinate either him or perhaps Dougie, this other guy. That much was a little unclear to me. I don't know. Yeah, how you would place that, I'm not sure. And also the shot of the woman with her child who is taking some sort of pill with whiskey, which I didn't quite know what to make of. That was, for a sequence that didn't seem to have a total place within the show, that was a fairly extended sequence, even if it was maybe only, all told, 2.5 minutes.
I mean, maybe she'll be a witness to something, who knows. But I mean, there's this whole sequence with Cooper in a casino where, curiously, he's seeing little digital inserts of the Black Lodge appearing above all these slot machines, which I think since Fire Walk With Me, we associate the Black Lodge explicitly with very dark imagery. But the second I realized he's now like almost mining it for comedy made me kind of reconfigure my expectations a little.
It is weird. I mean, it's appreciated though how quickly he's willing to not just lighten the tone, but I think even the texture of the show alters significantly when he's in Las Vegas in the casino. And has Lynch ever shot something in Las Vegas before? I don't think so. Recall, and that's kind of strange because Las Vegas seems like the perfect Lynch setting. The sort of the very gilded surfaces, the really dark underbelly. And I like how him finally doing it is a severely autistic Dale Cooper winning at the slot machines, being guided by the Black Lodge, essentially. Saying repeatedly, call for help. And I like how, in part, there's sort of this weird layer of unreality to it, and the fact that nobody seems to be alarmed by him and what he's doing. Even the woman who is guiding him says something, she just kind of seems kind of tired, like, Dougie, come on, you got to put on your seatbelts, or him not knowing how to get out of the car, or him not knowing. I love the little visual gag of him getting hit by the revolving door as well.
Also, we get to see, during the transfer sequence, we get to see Bad Coop vomiting up what I assume is Garmin Bozia.
Yeah, that would seem to be it. Something very foul.
A delightfully grotesque image.
I love those insert shots of him just kind of driving looking woozy. I thought that was actually quite funny.
And, of course, when Dougie gets sucked into the Black Lodge and then turned into a pearl.
Something along those lines, yes.
So, yeah. we're getting some good stuff here, I just want to say. Back in Twin Peaks, though, we have some more scenes with Hawk and Andy and Lucy specifically.
Yeah, so those sequences for me are the only ones where I found myself shifting in my seat a bit, where those scenes feel kind of long and distended for that matter. Just, not to come across sounding so baffled by something that's seemingly simple, but they seem to just play out for quite a long time and with, again, no real musical accompaniment, nothing but diegetic sound of them kind of talking to each other. And even something along the lines of Hawk saying, all right, I'll have a seat. And then proceeding to pull out the seat and sit down feels off to me. The rhythm of it is very weird. It kind of plays as something that Lynch finds funnier than just about anybody else. And I'm wondering how you were taking them.
There's another very distended comedy scene, which I imagine we're definitely going to be talking about later.
Yes, we will absolutely be talking about.
With some of these scenes, I'm genuinely curious if they're trying to actually do like anti-comedy.
That is interesting. I mean, Lucy talking about how she ate chocolate to fight against gas problems is just just feels like such an indulgence. And anti-comedy is an interesting proposal, but is it? I don't know. Not sure.
We finally get reintroduced to Gordon Cole and Albert back in Philadelphia. And, I'll make a note of it when we talk about a later scene, but I was actually pleasantly surprised, or maybe I just forgotten, how good Lynch's acting actually is in these two episodes. Because I think mostly the core character of Gordon Cole is, I wouldn't say a gimmick, but it's, it's supposed to be funny that you're seeing David Lynch on screen shouting. But I thought his performance was genuinely quite good in these two episodes. And Miguel Ferrer as well, I thought played the character somewhat differently, more, I'd say, genuinely angry than sarcastic, really.
I would say he seemed more how I'd imagine an FBI agent than the actual, well, not the actual, the earlier Albert Rosenfields is my perception. There's definitely something, yeah, hardened by time about him in that way. And I think that's also kind of relating to what I had said in the previous episode. I think it's also colored knowing that he died earlier this year. There's kind of a quality of, there is like a very weathered quality to the character that I think comes through more strongly. And with Gordon Cole as well, who doesn't seem to shout as much, or he doesn't shout as loudly, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, there's a scene, again, we'll talk about the next hour, but towards the end of the fourth hour that I thought, again, I was very surprised by how good Lynch's acting was in the scene, where he again speaks very quietly. But I guess we might as well talk about episode 4, and we're not quite going totally chronologically here, but do you want to talk about the elephant in the room regarding episode 4?
Okay, so I think far and away the most discussed and speculated casting tidbit from a year ago was how, and for that matter, why Michael Cera would be coming into the world of Twin Peaks. Because that's the kind of thing that sort of, I mean, if you were to sort of pull an internet slot machine of property and actor, Michael Cera Twin Peaks is one very probable combination. It sounds like a joke, basically. And as it turns out, it is very much a joke in a way that I was really not prepared for. So, I was watching this with two friends of mine, and when they said, you know, Wally, a.k.a. Lucy and Andy's son, is outside, my friend kind of went, oh man, is this it? Is this what's going to happen? And then, yeah, I mean, he shows up, and it is Michael Cera wearing Marlon Brando's outfit from The Wild One, talking in one of the most strangely consistent Marlon Brando impersonations I've seen in some time, which isn't to say one of the best, but he at least knows to stress certain matters of cadence and pronunciation. And the scene goes on for about 4 minutes of him talking about his journeys across America and how he has great respect for Sheriff Truman and the new Sheriff Truman, we should say, who's played by none other than Robert Forster, who shows up in this episode. And I found it fairly funny. I mean, I'm not gonna act as if I was really annoyed by it. I think I actually could have watched it go on for longer, in part because the sequence itself sort of played as a dare on everybody's part. So it was almost, you know, a game of chicken in a way of who's gonna stop first. Is it gonna be Cera or Lynch? And I'm not sure who stopped first, honestly, watching it. But him wearing his jacket with Wally emblazoned on it, wearing the hat, and Harry Goaz and Kimmy Robertson looking clearly kind of uncomfortable, having to stand there with their hand on his shoulder as he just keeps going and going. Also the fact that it's a single camera setup of Cera, which makes me think that there's an even longer version of it out there, and or that he was basically told, okay, just go. Just run with this. Was that scripted? I really don't know. And so afterwards, this friend and I were trying to rationalize why that's there. And we were kind of baffled, but I sort of came up with a theory as to it. I'm curious if you did. I'm curious if you had some sort of thinking behind it.
Well, I almost wondered if maybe it was going to be kind of like Lil at the beginning of Fire Walk With Me, and somehow there's going to be a scene later where, like, Sheriff Truman, the new Sheriff Truman, I should say, is like, has a flashback to that monologue and somehow a clue to that.
Sure. That seems very probable, actually. I mean, you know, what's the line? Their steps are the highways and byways of my heart, or something along those lines. Or he goes, I thought of Lewis and Clark, the first Caucasians to ever see this part of the land. Right. Yeah, and it's funny, though, because I did think to myself, the Lewis and Clark reference is sort of a callback to Mark Frost's The Secret History of Twin Peaks, which deals rather extensively with Lewis and Clark and works them into the Twin Peaks mythology, as does the inclusion of a new character, played by none other than Krista Bell, a singer-songwriter who Lynch has really taken under his wing. Hey, Ethan, have you listened to any of Krista Bell's music?
I have heard the song she sings at the end of Inland Empire.
Okay, sure. Well, it's her music is kind of a funny thing because it is very, I mean, either she is a huge Lynch fan, sort of hit the jackpot, or has been shaped very much by him. But needless to say, the music sounds extremely Lynchian. And she plays this FBI agent, Tamara Preston, who is sort of the central figure of The Secret History of Twin Peaks. What's funny is, I don't think having read the book will necessarily flesh out the experience of watching the character, but it was interesting to get some confirmation there, I thought. And I like the idea that Mark Frost is particularly endeared to this character, who perhaps Gordon Cole and Albert Rosenfield have some prurient interests in, based on one shot in particular, but and a certain dialogue exchange, of course. But let's go back to Wally Brando for a second. So yes. I was thinking to myself, it's funny how on this iteration of Twin Peaks, some 4 hours in, we haven't really seen any young people, or at least we haven't seen young people in the town itself. And one of the things that most defines the show and the characters is that they seem to be trapped in this, they're trapped in this place somewhere between the 50s and the 90s, right? And I like the idea that the first Twin Peaks youth that we really get to spend time with, or at least a youth of an offspring of Twin Peaks residents, has no subtlety to him whatsoever as far as his 50s connections. It is the most basic, shallow cut 50s character. It's one step short of just being Fonzie, basically, right? And I like that it's also played by, I like that he's played by this this very kind of like 21st century comedic actor, somebody who has, you know, is one of the more prominent young comedic performers of his day, is in this sequence playing this very kind of, again, basic level 50s figure, as if the subtlety of that component of the show has been lost completely, and perhaps the show won't try to do that, which I don't think it has been trying to do, clearly. I mean, this is so much a modernization of Twin Peaks, right? So this is maybe almost like a last gasp, a dying breath of that particular strand of the show. I could also be completely wrong in saying this, and it's just a silly joke on Lynch's part, but the fact that it's that particular reference I find very intriguing.
Yes, and we should mention actually very soon before that is the reemergence of fan favorite, or actually maybe just my favorite, Bobby Briggs being revealed that he's now a police officer, which to me makes sense for his character. Actually, he feels like the kind of guy who would be like, you know, the reckless youth who's, you know, the son of authority who with age kind of conforms.
I found something funny and maybe even a bit cruel about his walking into the room and seeing Laura's photo, and suddenly it becomes a very different show than what we've seen so far. The Bottle of Menta music kicks in. It's perhaps the second most famous piece of music from the show outside of the theme song. And then you have, the camera pushes in, he starts crying, and he says, brings back some memories, which is the self-titled of the show. But then the reverse shot of that is Robert Forster staring at him kind of puzzled as to what exactly is going on. Which I thought that was an interesting, I thought that was an interesting placement of a nostalgic item in the show.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting too about his character is I believe there's this line where he's trying to kind of sound folksy, where he's like, "I got a pee so bad my teeth are floating." What is that? What he said?
Yeah, I couldn't quite make out what he was saying.
There's something sort of, I don't know, interesting about someone who's almost visibly uncomfortable at being folksy and putting on a mask. I found interesting, and bringing back Robert Forster, I mean, I really like Michael Ancine a great deal, but I do think that Forster, as evidenced in that Wally scene, I think just has the perfect kind of straight man, deadpan face and voice of almost any working actor today, I find. Mm-hmm. So his casting is thumbs up.
And it's also really why he was cast in Mulholland Drive originally, lest we forget. He plays one of the detectives in the opening scene of that movie, and I don't think he appears at any other point in the film, right?
No.
But he was going to be, you know, a member of the TV show's cast, and he's in a couple of other scenes that were deleted from the transition from pilot to feature, which are of kind of a similar nature, too. Very deadpan, very straight ahead. And I appreciate him kind of bringing that back, because I'm also a big Robert Forster fan.
To talk about another one of the prolonged comedic sequences, there's, of course, the Dougie family breakfast scene, which we should say, we didn't even mention Naomi Watts is introduced as Dougie's wife. We're sort of to assume she is maybe a housewife. I mean, she's making breakfast for her husband, Dougie, and her son, Sonny Jim, who we should mention, that's also the name from a Lynch short, a 3-minute short from the late 90s, I think, which depicts two balloon head children squealing for 3 minutes. So that was a nice callback. But in this, we see Cooper kind of, again, trying on Dougie's clothes. And of course, in the transference to Cooper, he's apparently lost a lot of weight. So it's very large out of him, and it almost looks like he's wearing some odd form of Yeezys.
You're talking about the Kanye West sneakers?
Yeah, or the hoodies, the oversized hoodies.
Oh, yeah, I didn't notice.
I think it, because Kanye is a big Lynch fan, so I think it was Kanye returning the favor. But also, or Lynch returning the favor, sorry. This sequence, I think, has some of the probably the goofiest comedic sequence in the 4 hours so far, the breakfast table scene.
Yeah, it interesting, I think, in part for the fact that it uses Dave Brubeck's Take 5, which, if I'm correct, is only the second instance of licensed music in the entire Twin Peaks. Can you think of what the first would be?
In the series or the film?
The series. It's a little piece of trivia.
Okay, let me think. Oh, is it Get Happy?
Oh, I didn't think of that. Oh, I guess I'm wrong. When does Get Happy play? Oh, well, there's also
Jersey Dotes and Dozy Dotes.
And Pennsylvania 65,000. I was thinking of Louis Armstrong's What a Wonderful World in the classic Lonely Souls episode. Nevertheless, it is very uncommon for the show to use licensed music, so I thought that was a fascinating choice. And yeah, I quite enjoyed that scene as he is tasting coffee again for the first time, and that serves as a rejoinder to fandom nostalgia that he has coffee again, and he kind of, on the one hand, seems to enjoy it, I suppose, but doesn't really know what to do with himself otherwise.
I mean, yeah. I think that was, yeah, you're right. That's the moment probably, you know, everyone watching this at home who was cosplaying and dressed up as a character expected him to say his quintessential damn good coffee line and then go, woo, but it didn't happen. And I will say, I watched this sequence twice the first time with just when it was streaming. And I was initially a little puzzled and befuddled that the episode was going there. But watching it again, actually, the face he makes after he spits out the coffee actually made me laugh out loud. I think,
no, it's great.
Again, I think McLaughlin's pretty wonderful in this 4 hours so far. Also, again, we get more with Gordon Cole, Albert, and Tamara Preston, or Tammy, and the return of Denise Bryson, probably the only bad season 2 stretch character we'll see acknowledged.
Just about, yeah. I'm kind of hoping for little Nikki figure into this. Wouldn't it be great if the guy who gets killed, the box viewer in the first part, was in fact a grown-up little Nikki?
Or James Wingman at the Roadhouse is
little Nikki. Yes, absolutely.
Also, we have them travel to the Black Hills of South Dakota and find the bad coop locked up. And I'll say again, this is another scene I appreciated far more on the rewatch. The basically, all three people, all three FBI agents, realizing that something is not right.
Yeah, that is maybe my favorite sequence of the entire show thus far. I found it at once very creepy and very kind of emotionally resonant as well. I found it fairly moving, them reconnecting with this person who they worked with, who they were, you know, really friends with for years, who they haven't seen in a long time. And they can tell that something is very clearly wrong, not least of which because there's some sort of modulation going on with Kyle MacLachlan's voice, which I'm sure you noticed.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I'm not even quite sure. He seems to be speaking at at almost 0.75% the normal speed, I was thinking. And I just those kind of the shots of Gordon Cole and Rosenfield in that void of some kind, which I thought was really wonderful. Yeah, and then that leads into what I thought was another wonderful sequence at the end of the episode, the shot reverse shot sort of day for night sequence, I guess it was. Would you say that was?
Looked that way. The blue filter, you could just say.
Yeah, it certainly looks that way. And that is a sequence kind of unlike anything. Again, sort of every sequence in this plays as either a twist on or unlike anything we've seen from Twin Peaks before. But I was thinking to myself how something about the intimacy and the closeness of that shot reverse shot exchange was really surprising to me. And that I also found quite touching too, something of still these sort of unspoken things between them. That sequence, the shot reverse shot dialogue, I found quite touching, this exchange between two colleagues and friends who've known each other for decades now and whose life are built on secrets, but still they're sharing that they're revealing that they have known things that they've been keeping from each other, and kind of the resentment and the hurt in Gordon Cole at that moment is kind of unlike anything we've ever seen from him before. And it speaks again to what you're saying about Lynch being an excellent actor. I also love how this plays almost as the first time his hearing problem is not played for a joke, which I thought was intriguing. That it actually causes him some physical pain to have his hearing aid turned on with the particular shuffling of the feet and the feedback that's caused by it. I really love that scene.
I think maybe this could be the first actual cliffhanger of these hours so far, which is alluding that there's someone back in Twin Peaks who can speak to Cooper. And it's up to us, really, to predict who that might be. It could be Audrey, could be Shelley, could be an unseen character, possibly whoever Laura Dern is playing. But also we kind of realize, I mean, I remember with the last episode you're talking about how the Chromatics appearance at the end felt like a bit of a victory lap. Now we kind of realize too that the Roadhouse performances are essentially just going to be the end credits, because probably they're having a heck of a hard time actually cutting these up into hour-long episodes where you can just cut to credits. So it's, I think, a nice way to kind of get around that problem.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of a split mind about them. I mean, I sort of feel that they're nice little breathers at the end of an episode, and I kind of like the delineation effect that it has, where you know you're at the end of an episode with that. But I kind of wish there was more of it, or I wish he was going a bit more full bore with it. In that there's kind of this thing of, they're not really full performances quite necessarily. I don't know. I mean, I guess I kind of wish there was something a bit more intimate about it. It feels kind of sudden to me. And I'm wondering how one of the things that I find kind of interesting is that, you know, in the editing process, Lynch had apparently not known exactly where parts were going to end. And so it makes sense that he would put those in as sort of the place markers. I wonder how it'll play when, at most 5 days past this series' conclusion, somebody edits together an 18-hour version of this whole thing, and you have the musical sequences kind of sitting there. you know? Mm-hmm. That's something I thought of.
Maybe they're like an intermission.
yeah, sort of little intermission things. But I think they're nice. I just kind of wish they were handled a bit differently.
Also, nothing quite touches the chromatics, I feel like, so far in terms of the quality of song or performance. But
We still got Sky Ferreira. We still got Sharon Van Etten. We still got Trent Reznor and his wife. Very sexist of me not to know his wife's name. Ethan, you absolutely know this. Who's his wife?
You can just call them How to Destroy Angels.
How to Destroy Angels, sure. Oh, yeah.
That's the band. Yeah. So we got stuff to look forward to.
I am looking forward to more of those, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Again, these are your two episodes that I found initially a little befuddling, but on the rewatch, much better, and I'm very excited for even more tonal shifts to come.
Yeah, and regarding the climax, I kind of wondered, I mean, yeah, there is sort of that cliffhanger as to what exactly is happening. I did sort of wonder if maybe it would be Annie, but it's probably not going to be because Heather Graham is not part of the cast, right?
Unless she got recast, though, it would seem odd to do that.
Yeah, that would seem weird. I mean, her response to it seemed to be along the lines of, I'm kind of surprised I wasn't asked back, so I don't know.
Only time will tell. And also, I'm very curious about, because probably in this one episode we've seen so far, Naomi Watts, probably her role seems a little puzzling. When they announced her in it, I figured she'd be like an FBI agent or someone, but I imagine it must be a pretty large role still to come. So, still very curious about that. And, I mean, we haven't even mentioned Philip Jeffries is in this, despite David Bowie's passing. So, there's another mystery of who's actually going to play him, even though we've heard his voice so far.
We heard his voice, yeah, which doesn't even resemble David Bowie's Southern accent at all, does it?
No.
Yeah, which I did get a little jolt of energy in the second part when he starts talking to Philip Jeffries, because that's probably my favorite scene in anything Twin Peaks, is that one little moment. And I guess he's still alive. Out there somehow, perhaps gone rogue regarding, I don't know.
Or maybe the Jeffries we saw in Fire Walk With Me is actually the bad Jeffries.
Very possibly, yeah.
Well, we'll just have to find out, sadly, in 2 weeks.
Yeah, that wait is going to be a little unfortunate.
But we got spoiled with 4 hours in on Sunday.
That's true.
But
yeah.
Again, we're gonna have a ton to talk about. And thank you for joining me, Nick.
Yes, thank you for being with me, Ethan.
And thank you for listening. So long.